Sometimes a sermon offers answers, and somewhat times it only poses questions. But there is a Yiddish saying that a good question is half the answer. And Einstein was believed to have said something like, that when faced with a challenging problem, a life or death question, if he only had an hour, he would spend 55 minutes just analyzing the question correctly. So I'm going to raise more questions than I answer, I believe, today, which may not be uncommon. And these questions circle around a very difficult debate I have in myself and with colleagues and friends that one might phrase as, how wide is the Overton window? The Overton window is this conceptual idea that there are certain things appropriate within public debate and certain things that are not allowed. Certain things that we should consider from a spectrum of viewpoints and certain things that are impermissible even to raise. So an obvious one would be racism and eugenics. In some communities, communism would be similarly outside or excluded from public debate. And this is an important question, I think, in this day and age, because I struggle in myself, and I imagine many of us do, with what is an appropriate cross-cultural, cross-political, cross-religious dialogue, and what do we not have to tolerate in dialogue? What can we say the other side is just wrong? To me, a current obvious one is the QAnon conspiracy theory. I won't even enter into that debate. Or potentially on another side, the sense that Israel doesn't have a right to exist or defend herself. And we can debate, I think a much clearer example is we can debate Israel's policies. Better that we debate it as Israeli citizens and not as American citizens. But any person who calls into question Israel's right to exist as a free, independent, and sovereign nation and homeland for the Jews is speaking not anti-Zionism or not questioning Israeli policy, but speaking as anti-Semitism, no doubt. So luckily with this question in my mind, Parshat Korach is an incredible place to find this struggle. Why? What is the deal with Korach's rebellion? Resh Lakish in the Talmud says that Korach got himself a very bad bargain, which is a phrase I'd never heard until this week, but I love that idea. Korach got himself a very bad bargain. And it seems at first blush that, like with the scouts of the last week, that their wickedness, to quote Midrash, is because they're given to contentiousness. The wickedness is a result of just the idea of fighting Moses' leadership. That stepping up in contentiousness, in challenge, is itself impermissible. There's not a great history in the rabbinic tradition of that. Of course, the Talmud is a list and litany and struggle, archive of struggles. Yet the Torah is a little bit less forgiving of debate, so we could consider that midrash, that analysis of Korach, why he is swallowed up in a pit, or according to even some midrashim, not swallowed. The better midrashim, the better rabbinic understanding of his faults might be that he becomes, in gaming terms, a rules lawyer. He picks apart all the subtleties of the law in front of Moses, not for any wisdom, not for any legal reason, but just to show himself smart and challenging him. Or he sets Moses up for mockery as a comedian. Those are better. And the Midrash suggests that all these things, all this contention is not contention itself, but contention over falsehood, over Korach's own literary and intellectual inventions. He's not speaking truth. He's just speaking to speak and challenge and inflate himself and make up stories. Probably think of that as demagoguery. Right? That's the suggestion, is that he is not striving for better policy, is not striving to share power, but striving just to aggrandize himself. And that challenge is inherent, actually, throughout the Parsha. One of the things that Korach says to Moshe, even if you bring the people to the land, in chapter 16, he says, would you blind their eyes? Idiomatically, it's translated as hoodwinking them. And that seems to be a pernicious danger in all leadership. And certainly, I think it was Kissinger who said that absolute power corrupts absolutely, that we feel the need to grasp onto power more than we feel the need to seek honesty, and so we hoodwink others. So this struggle is really live in the Parsha. What is demagoguery? What is appropriate speech? What are the limits of civil discourse? Are there opinions we don't even have to consider? And the trick is, again, how wide is the Overton window? I think it's understandable that there would be an Overton window, that we don't contemplate having serious debates about genocide. We don't contemplate having serious debates about expropriation of property so that we can create a national oil magnet. Though some countries do it. But those are not in the American debate. We don't have those questions about nationalizing personal property or about genocide. Those aren't for us. Those are clearly outside the Overton window, but there are subtler things. You know, immigration policy. What can you say and what is inappropriate about immigration policy would be an obvious place. Where is the line between acceptable discourse and unacceptable? Hard to say. Jonathan Schraub, an attorney writing on Korach, says that Korach is considered by the rabbis to be a demagogue wrapped in the cloak of a Democrat. I was brought to mind Erdogan, that there was this super anxiety in Turkey and Egypt about a decade plus ago that the Islamic parties, such as Erdogan's party and the Muslim Brotherhood, would come to power by virtue of democracy, but that would be the last election once they got in. With the Muslim Brotherhood, it was not true, but with Erdogan, it seems to be his call. And I think that's much more personal than religious. So I'm going to offer a rubric that comes from the 1980s, but I think is undergirding parts of our Torah. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the great senator, said in 1983 that everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not his own facts. Right? And I think that's the rubric, right? I think that's the rubric, certainly in modern civil discourse. You're entitled to your own opinion about which president you vote for. You're not entitled to the opinion that I just read this, that cicadas, since they have 17-year cycles and Q is the 17th letter of the alphabet, that the cicadas are part of some massive conspiracy theory. And Carol's reaction is priceless. Yeah, I just read this. And when the cicada landed on Joe Biden, it was Q, you know, one of Q's predictions. That's nuts. That is not acceptable civil discourse. We can debate where the cicadas will land and whether you should eat them, but you can't debate that cicadas, because they have a prime number cycle which has biological basis, are somehow connected to our proofs of QAnon. You can have your own opinion, but not your own facts. And in the Midrash for this week's parasha, they think about Doeg and Achitophel, who were, I think, rivals or foils for Solomon, maybe David. They describe them, similarly to Korach, as a house full of straw. There were holes in the house, and you could see that straw sort of used as insulation, probably is what they're getting at. But eventually the straw started to poke out, and everyone knew that the house was just made out of straw. You know, that to me is a symbol of your argument is weak. The Talmud would tear that apart. There are certain arguments, Marjorie Taylor Greene comes to mind, where she says, you can't prove to me that it's not true. I think the Talmud would tear that argument apart like a wet tissue. So your arguments have to hold water and be based on some fact and some rationale and logic. And the Talmud is really, if nothing else, a book of logic. And I think another piece of what makes an opinion valid in the Overton window is your ability to change it. Ability to reconsider. We see this all the time. In the Jewish community, we used to see it, and certainly in the 1990s, I saw it to a point where it was painful. Inability to reconsider one's opinion about Israel. And now it's all over the world, right? People have an inability to reconsider their opinion about President Trump, President Biden, Mitch McConnell, whoever it might be, civic figures, that we respond from a tribalist point of view and not with our rational selves. Not thoughtfully. The Chatam Sofer, in thinking about Korach's fault, debates, I think, based on the Midrash that Korach may not have died, is that a fool's transgression can be amended, but an apostate will never mend his thoughts in 1,000 years. Like, there are examples in the Talmud of people saying, "Oh, I got that wrong," right? Or, "Oh, I was misquoted," or, "Oh, I believed that before I heard X." That's an incredible, powerful thing. That's not flip-flopping. That's being smart. It's being clever. It's being able to assimilate information. It's being a learner, frankly, which I think, if nothing else, our congregation values supremely. And also, I think an important piece of whether your viewpoint, whether your opinion ought to be or is even permissible in public discourse is, are you really engaging in debate, or are you just showing yourself off? The demagogue cloaked as the Democrat, the rules lawyer, the comedian. Are you doing it for real, sincere reasons or not? So there's a scene where Moses tries to fix the behavior of Korach and his merry band, and they refuse to speak to him. They refuse to come out of their tents. And that, to some of our sages, is the worst of it all. Not that they had the wrong opinion, not that they challenged Moses' opinion, not that they sought their own power or aggrandizement, but they refused to debate. They refused to consider. I think it's pretty obvious why that would be vital to our sages, right? They're gonna put 3,000 folio pages in the Talmud of continual debate. Isn't that's one of the worst possible transgressions, is being unwilling to challenge and be challenged, being unwilling to talk, saying, "I'm not going to talk about this anymore." So you need to have powerful, truth-based, fact-based, numbers-based, science-based arguments. You have to be willing to change your mind, and you have to be willing to enter the public debate. Right? Even there are really wonderful records of people who are in Stormfront, or devotees of Richard Spencer, people who are deeply devoted to the white nationalist cause, people who are deeply embedded in racist sub-societies, who came out and moved out. I actually have a friend whose brother was Richard Spencer's roommate at the University of Chicago. Crazier things have happened. So the ability to be transformed by logic, the ability to be transformed and open to debate, is probably a part of what makes an opinion possible. But also that it's not a facile opinion. This is not always true. In mathematics, sometimes the obvious answer is the right one. Occam's razor tells us that. But sometimes a simple explanation is the wrong one. Soloveitchik, in describing the issues around Korach, says that religion deepens the problems but never intends to solve them. So in a way, my talk today, that offers more questions than answers, is in a great tradition of deepening the problems but not solving them. If you can't accept paradox, what are you really debating? And the one I don't know if I'm proud, it's just interesting to me how easy I can see it, is the debate around abortion, right? I have the ability to see every side of that issue, because when life starts is a somewhat arbitrary issue according to philosophers, right? There are societies where life doesn't start until you're 8 years old. I was in a society once where if a child died before eight, no one really blinked an eye, right? So I'm able to understand that debate on all sides. And if you can't, at some level, in many debates, some debates, understand paradox and deepen the problem and go deeper with the person and your opponent in a debate, not your enemy, but your opponent, it's a very shallow place to be. So I want to leave you with a phrase that gets repeated in this parsha that I think is really funny. First, if I recall correctly, Moses says it to Korach. No, Korach says it to Moses, and Moses says to Korach this phrase, Rav lachem. Rav being you are great, or greatness, or enlargedness. And lachem to you, plural, to y'all. That's a fault in debate, right? I'm just using the debate to enhance my own stature. I'm just using the debate as a pretense to make myself bigger. I was reading a very interesting article just briefly before I got here in the Washington Post about how conservative senators, with a lot of wisdom, are very concerned about Biden's infrastructure plan because it may trigger inflation. But they can't seem to get traction on the news because all people on right-wing media seem to want to talk about our cultural grievances, like wokeness and teaching critical race theory, right? Or banning Dr. Seuss, right? They have a very legitimate factual problem, which is that putting trillions of dollars into an economy that's doing well can trigger serious inflation. But no one cares, right? The journalists seem to want to elevate other issues of debate because it makes them bigger. It increases their ratings, quite frankly. Are you doing this debate for ratings or to get at some deeper truth? Are you doing it to deepen the problems or just to offer a facile explanation? Are you doing it because you're engaging with another human being, or are you doing it to avoid the conversation? Are you willing to be changed by the debate or not? Are you basing the debate on facts and concrete evidence, or is it just on whimsy? Those are the questions that our tradition would offer us in determining what is a valid opinion that is worthy of public consideration.